Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jeff Schlesinger on behalf of Matthew Hensley. Matthew Hensley is a 24-year-old man who had no criminal history prior to this case, and he's presently serving a sentence of 124 months in the Bureau of Prisons. The conduct which was the basis for Mr. Hensley's sentence was that he participated in electronic conversations over the Internet with an individual who claimed to be a 13-year-old girl. In reality, the individual was a series of federal agents posing as a teenage female. Although Mr. Hensley never touched the individual and never even met the individual, and in fact it would have been impossible for him to do so because the individual did not really exist, he was convicted of using the Internet to persuade the individual, whom he believed to be a female under the age of 18, to engage in sexual activity. Other than the transcripts of the conversation, the key evidence of Mr. Hensley's conversations with the federal agents in this case, the key evidence came from another young female with whom Mr. Hensley had carried on an Internet relationship for a period of years. The trial court chose to admit the testimony of the other young female as evidence of the knowledge or intent of Mr. Hensley to pursue the relationship with the young female who had been created by the federal agents.
Now, Mr. Schlesinger, the government, of course, argues that it uses this 404B evidence to show his intent and motive and what he was doing. And the transcript shows that in opening argument, I'm not sure if it was you or somebody else, it was said on Mr. Hensley's behalf, "Our evidence will show you that Matthew Hensley has no history as a predator whatsoever." And then later he said he did not believe that person was 13. So the door seems to be open very early to this type of evidence on behalf of the government, prejudicial though it may be in other ways, but I think the government has a good argument that it's not propensity, it's absence of mistake, planned knowledge, et cetera, all those 404B things.
And I was not the trial attorney in this case, Your Honor.
I don't mean to be personal about anybody, but that was said in the opening statement.
And I understand your point. Actually, I think the way the evidence developed, the actual theory of defense was that had Mr. Hensley made, I think the trial counsel was claiming Mr. Hensley didn't know this was really a 13-year-old girl and was engaging in some sort of fantasy. However, again, 404B does restrict it to specific instances which it may, or elements which it may prove, and in this case it was limited to intent and knowledge. And
let's just focus on intent then. Given that introduction to the case, why can the government not say he intended to have the forbidden interaction with this, he thought, minor, because he did in fact have the same kind of interactions with another minor? That was his intent. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a fantasy. It wasn't, that he thought, you never know with Internet who the heck you're talking to anyway. It's all of that.
Well, the criminal act is actually more than merely having the conversations. It's intending to persuade the other person to engage in sexual relations.
Of course, but this is one element, but then the government does have the evidence that he drives to the... I mean, this is all part of this giant sting that was going on in Valparaiso in August of 2006, and we've seen many cases, including the next case, all coming out of that. But they have other evidence of steps that he took.
Yes. Well, and we did raise an issue on the substantial step. But I think the testimony of the other young woman is somewhat of a separate issue, and it does overlap. However, first of all, I don't think it necessarily that this circuit has recognized the four-pronged test to evaluate 404B evidence to determine whether it's unduly prejudicial. And my opinion is that it doesn't really go to show intent because he never did have a sexual relationship and never even discussed. Well, discussed having sexual intercourse with the other female.
The problem that I think I see here is that you conceded in the brief that the second requirement of 404B is met, which is that the evidence shows the other act is similar enough and close enough in time to be relevant to the matter and issue. So if it's similar enough to be relevant to the matter and issue, I think it's very difficult to argue that it cannot be used to establish intent.
Well, I think it has to, the court, obviously trial court and the court on review also has to engage in a balancing test. 404B is meant to be a rule of exclusion, and in this type of case, a case involving potential sexual abuse of minors, that evidence is going to be even more prejudicial because any evidence of that, I think, will turn a jury against a criminal defendant and make the possibility of determining on propensity even greater. There, another problem in this case, the federal statute requires that, and as an element of the offense, that a state statute be violated also. And the government cited two Indiana statutes in this case, which it believed had been violated, and they do entail somewhat different activity. One is broader and talks about sexual activity. The other does deal with persuading an underage child or encouraging to have sexual intercourse. Then the government also sets up the facts of this case because they are the supposed victim in the case. So they are 13 and they try to engage Mr. Hensley to participate in, or to persuade them to participate in sexual intercourse. And because the, again, if it were, well, I don't believe the other incident goes to intent because he never attempted to persuade that other person to engage in sexual intercourse. The government shouldn't be able to charge more broadly to increase the possibility of using prejudicial evidence that might otherwise not be relevant, especially when they create all the facts of this case, other than Mr. Hensley's transportation, which does lead me to the second point on the substantial step. And the United States versus Awada was decided after I wrote the brief in this case, and I do agree with the government that that would increase the burden on that to plain error. We still believe that it would, that even though Mr. Hensley traveled to the vicinity of the meeting place, that is not sufficient to constitute a substantial step. And primarily that's based upon the context, which the Gladish decision talks about evaluating, again, because this is a sensitive crime and the government has so much control over the facts of the case, look at the context of the conversations and the actions. And Mr. Hensley's last conversation, after engaging in these admittedly sexual conversations, he says, "I don't think sex is a good idea. Maybe we'll just hang out." Now, that may be suspicious, but that does, I think, negate the evidence that this was a substantial step towards having a meeting because he never even arrives at the location.
He says he sees too many police cars.
But I don't think his motive, you know, Judge Posner wrote Gladish, and he talks, we're creating a class of criminals here, and I don't think the court should broaden it unnecessarily. If somebody talks about a bank robbery or a murder or anything and sees a police officer and changes their mind, that's probably not criminal activity. I believe Mr. Hensley would fall into that category. Regarding the last issue on the guideline calculation, as the court may be aware, Mr. Hensley's original sentencing date was set on a specific day, and the guidelines changed after that time, so his guideline range did become higher.
But there was a mandatory minimum anyway of 120 months, even
right,
if the lower range had applied.
Right. And it so it's only a five-month difference. The court could not, we could see the court couldn't give him below 120 months. But the government argument is that the cases say the court has to do a proper guideline calculation. We're contending that this is not proper. I understand that the Demaree case would probably certainly indicates that the court should use the guidelines in effect on the day of sentencing. But in this case, it was continued by the government. And I think it's important to note that and make an exception. Whether the government's motives are pure or not, they should not be allowed to increase a criminal sentence by delaying a sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. Morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Josh Kohler for Appalachia United States. The defendant tries to argue essentially that even though he initiated a telephone conversation with Jen Endy 13, he then immediately after learning that she was a 13-year-old girl told her in very crude language that he wanted to have sex with her, continued that conversation, and drove to a park where he was supposed to meet her. He didn't meet the elements of the charged crime, 18 U.S.C. 2422B. And the defendant also ignores, for the most part in the sufficiency argument, the fact that he was grooming this individual who he thought was going to be his minor victim for an unlawful sex act. He didn't just use his one online conversation, group of conversations that defense counsel spoke of. He also created multiple personas. He went so far as to get a picture of a real underage girl, pose as another person on the internet, so in the guise of this underage girl, he could talk to Jen Indy 13, tell her how good of an idea it was to engage in the types of things that he really wanted to do, and tell her she didn't have to worry about getting pregnant. He then created yet another persona where he was a different 24-year-old man telling the defendant again how wonderful it was to engage in sex acts with grown men. Now, that's truly troubling. And those acts are enough in and of themselves to constitute the substantial step.
So why does the government then have to bring in the 404B evidence of the interactions with TG, given all of these multiple personas, which of course are part of your case? I mean, the government has all these cases out there from this Indianapolis thing, as you know.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'd like to answer that in two ways. One, I think your very question goes to the fact that it would be completely harmless, even if the court were to find error in the 404B because of all this evidence. Two, the government is allowed to prove up its case how it sees fit within the strictures of the rules of evidence. And U.S. v. Coate makes clear that the defendant's knowledge that the victim is under 13, or his intended victim is under 13, 14, 16, depending upon the statute, is an essential element of these 2422B prosecutions. And Judge Wood, I think you pointed out earlier that the defendant went right out of the box in opening, talking about how he didn't think that this individual was truly 13. Also brought that up in closing, saying, quote, "You got to be convinced that he believed this child was under the age of 14. Now, that's important because that was really the only defense in this case. And that's borne out by the fact it's the defense that was presented. But I think it's also important to keep in mind, even if the defendant hadn't said that, the government has to prove up its case. And it has to prove up that the defendant thought that he was talking to a 13-year-old girl. And the prior 404B conduct that was admitted pursuant to a limiting instruction goes directly to the defendant's intent, motive, and lack of a mistake.
Now, of course, the course of these conversations, as Mr. Schlesinger points out, is very much in the government's control. You know, what the alleged girl, you know, the girl character in the conversation says, how sexually experienced she is, whether she draws him out, whether she, you know, keeps him talking. There's something uncomfortable about all of that.
And respectfully, Your Honor, what doesn't the government control? The government doesn't control what the defendant says and what he did. And within minutes of contacting Amanda 13 online, in a conversation the defendant initiated.
You mean Jen
13, 13, I'm sorry. That's
yeah, Amanda
the
was a
case.
Different case.
I apologize, Your Honor. within minutes.
We all get to that.
Yes. He's talking to her about sexually charged conduct. And he's the one who chose to drive to the meeting point, and only left when through counter-surveillance, he realized that police officers were there.
Now, he shoots her one more IM, and then he tries to erase everything? Is that how the sequence works?
And again, that's, I think, consciousness of guilt. Yeah. I also think it's important to point out, and it's in the record at Exhibit 4, defense understandably brings up this telephone call where supposedly the defendant is getting cold feet. Well, that's not what the record bears out. What the record bears out is that just days before that, on August 8th, the defendant said, right after talking about whether or not Jen Indy 13's mother would be home, well, if she's not going to be home all night, we can, quote, watch a movie and hang out and get drunk, and then we can have sex. So the fact he's talking about watching a romantic movie that night, it's just further grooming, and it's further grooming to make sure her defenses are down. The fact he mentions maybe not having sex, the jury is allowed to look at Exhibit 4, understand that this is part of the grooming that the defendant did. The defendant didn't create three online personas to talk to this young girl about sex, to convince her sex was a good idea, drive to that location, and then not have sex. He saw the police. That's what stopped him. Not that that's the end-all and be-all. The fact is he took a substantial step regardless. I'd also like to just mention that in terms of the guidelines arguments, guidelines are they're just that now, obviously, a source of guidelines for judges. The amended guidelines were already out. They were something that the government very well could have put in front of the judge. For the very reason stated in DeMarie, the fact that the guidelines were changing, the day doesn't really matter. I mean, the government...
But, you know, I mean, there's something a little bit wrong about this, because if the sentencing had gone forward in October, as it was originally scheduled, and the advisory guidelines had dictated a range below the statutory minimum, then the statutory minimum would have also been, at least from a guideline point of view, the maximum. And so whatever guidance the judge wanted to take from them would have been capped at 120 months. As it is, with the rollover to the next round of guidelines, the guidance that the judge gets turns out to be a much higher range. And the statutory minimum, of course, still has to be respected, but now the judge is being told, you know, the best judgment of the Sentencing Commission, et cetera, is that you can go up much higher. And so he goes up to 125. Now, I realize 5 months isn't everything, but the Supreme Court has told us, and I think rightly so, that people care about even an extra day, much less an extra month or an extra 5 months. So why shouldn't we,
Judge Wood, I think when we look
this.
At, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Go ahead. Yeah.
When we look at what Judge Simon said at the sentencing, it makes clear that what he was looking at was the defendant's conduct. Judge Simon even says, hey, in the typical case, I think the mandatory minimum's a little too low, but not for you. Mandatory minimum's not too high. It's not too high for you because of what you've done. So although I have a problem with this mandatory minimum in some cases, your case I'd go above regardless. Now, he also says that he is sentencing the defendant without a thumb on the scale of the guidelines. Judge Simon looked at all the 3553A factors. He looked at the guidelines. Respectfully, there's very little difference if the judge is following the procedures he's supposed to employ, whether or not he's looking at the actual guidelines in effect, or some guidance that he's allowed to look at because it's relevant. It's the same thing. It's the Sentencing Commission taking a look at the 3553A factors and coming out with guidance. Whether it's the actual guidelines or proposed changes to the guidelines, it's still the Sentencing Commission fulfilling its statutory obligations, and it's the very reason that courts have noticed time and time again, and it's the reason there's a rebuttable presumption on appeal that a within-guideline sentence is reasonable, because it's to be expected. Because here you have a panel of experts looking at 3553A factors, you have a judge looking at the same 3553A factors, and if they come to the same conclusion, that's not something that should be surprising. And the fact that the sentencing guideline had changed its mind, it had still gone through that process. The judge could have weighted that essentially with the same weight And see, what if it would have been the guidelines in effect at the time? It was already in the Code of Federal Register. It was already out there. The government certainly could have brought it up at sentencing to say, this is what the guidelines say on day X, but the Sentencing Commission, in doing its very difficult and very time-consuming and very thorough job, has already said they're wrong. And the court would have to look at that under the 3553A factors. See, my time is almost up. I would like to mention briefly that, well, my time is up.
I would mention it briefly.
There was a limiting instruction in this case. The 404B evidence was properly limited, even if not. It's harmless error because of all the evidence and the sufficient to the evidence claim tries to take certain pieces of evidence in a vacuum and doesn't consider the entire case. The government would ask that the sentence and conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. But don't go away. I would... How much time? What?
That's all. That's okay. I don't have that. Just on the limiting instruction, Mr. Kohler was correct, and that was limited to intent and knowledge, and I think that's important to focus on for the court, and it may fall within that, but not alleging motive or anything else. Regarding Judge Simon's sentencing order, I believe I read it differently from Mr. Kohler. He talks about how high the mandatory minimum is, and then indicates that he's going to give a guideline sentence. It's the government suggests in their brief that he could have said, well, this is congressional intent, so I'm going to go with the higher range, but he never mentions that. Therefore, I think that because we believe that his guideline range was incorrect, and also due to the possibility of the government increasing the sentence, we would ask that it be remanded for resentencing.
Well, thank you both so very much. Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger, for taking this case on at the behest of the court. You have our deep thanks for the fine job you did for your client. Thank you so very, very much. Thank you. And thank you as well, Mr. Kohler.